Pre-recorded, completely unscripted, and about as organised as the thought processes of some members of the Australian Senate, you're listening to news, views and opinions on events from here at home and around the globe on politics, business and society in general. This is the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove.
And I'd like to thank myself for that introduction. Dear listener, it's Scott, a.k.a. the Velvet Glove here, and I'm not with Trevor, a.k.a. the Iron Fist tonight. I'm joined by Paul, a.k.a. the 12th Man. How are you, Paul?
Very well, Scott. How are you?
I'm pleased to hear that.
And hello, listener.
Yes, let's hope there's more than one.
But anyway. Let's hope.
We'll start off with our disclaimer. Myself and Paul are both members of the Secular Party, but that does not mean that this is the views expressed tonight will be the views and opinion of the Secular Party. To find out what is, go to the website and consider joining up. Okie dokes. Myself and other contributor to the podcast, Deep Throat, went to the meeting the book launch, Stealing from a Child, The Injustice of Marriage Equality by David Van Gend. And that was last Friday night on 23rd September 2016. I've got a synopsis here that's been written by Deep Throat, mm-hmm. So I will try not to read it, but yeah.
Did you get an autographed copy?
No, we didn't. Oh. Yeah, I had to pay $29 to buy the book or something like that, and I wasn't going to be giving that sort of money over to the opponents of marriage equality.
I never thought so.
No, it was very interesting. They are ready for this marriage equality plebiscite. I left the evening and walked out and looked at Deep Throat and said, shit. Oh, I shouldn't say that, should I?
This is Australia, you can say that.
And he said, what? And I said to him, I said, they're ready for this. And he said, yes, they are. Mm. And David Van Gend was wrapping up his presentation, and he said these words. He said, we can win this. And you know what? They can. They are in a position that they can argue it, and they can argue it strongly, and that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And quite frankly, they're ready for it. They are far better prepared than the supporters of marriage equality. The supporters of marriage equality are split. You've got some groups off arguing you shouldn't have a plebiscite. You've got other groups that are saying, well, if we're going to have a plebiscite, we've just got to get ourselves organised to fight it, and that sort of stuff. The fear I have is that on the 10th of October, I believe that's when the Labor Party are discussing it, is that they will come down on the side and say, well, yes, we're going to have it. It's then going to take 6 weeks to get ourselves organised. And in that 6 weeks, the ACL can be out there running already and putting in a decent fight.
Mm.
I
think they've been ready for a while, Scott, frankly. I think they've seen this coming from a fair while back, and they've been gearing up for it, surely.
I would have thought so, yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. It's a concern, though. It was, it really was a concern being there that night.
Yeah.
And, you know, George Christensen was there, and, oh, God. The man is unstable. the way he was speaking, you'd swear that the society was about to vote itself off a ledge. Yeah. You know, it was crazy.
Yeah.
Anyway, if we go through this synopsis, the meeting was attended by Malcolm Roberts, Senator for One Nation, in support of the book launch. He did not speak. George Christensen also was in support of, and following David Van Gend launching the book, he had something to say. The meeting appeared to have recognisable ACL members present, and the chairperson for the evening was Wendy Francis, who, by the way, is very nice.
I don't know her.
Well, yeah, she's the Queensland director for the ACL, so you'd think that she's an absolute lunatic, which she is, but myself and Deep Throat left for the night, and she came running out afterwards. Oh, gentlemen, we turned around. She said, oh, thank you very much for coming, because she must have picked up on Deep Throat's questions that we were in the Supporting Marriage Equality Act.
Since,
yeah. Mm. Anyway. Yeah. The thrust of his book is, firstly, that marriage equality will be an injustice to children. He claims that all children deserve a mother and a father. Secondly, gay and lesbian couples already have all the same rights before the law as heterosexual couples have, and therefore there is no discrimination occurring against this group. Thirdly, he was arguing that what can only be described as a slippery slope argument, that marriage equality will lead to children being exposed to unacceptable behaviours and ideas.
Did he give any examples?
Oh, yeah, he did. And it was all around safe schools. You know, they won't get over safe schools. Mm. They really won't.
They see safe schools as basically promoting the so-called homosexual lifestyle. Is that
well,
what it's about?
Yeah, and the gender fluidity and that sort of stuff there and that sort of stuff.
Which they find threatening,
well,
clearly.
They do, yes, obviously. You know, it's...
It threatens the traditional family structure.
Well, I don't know whether it does or doesn't, but...
According to their...
Well, according to their view of the world, yeah. You know, but then again, you look at Corey Bernardi, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, the way he's conducted himself over marriage equality, it's... one is tempted to say he doth protest too much.
Yeah, but as with other issues, Scott, I'm always willing to listen to their argument if they have one.
Yeah.
What I'm thoroughly tired of is people branding each other, regardless of which side of this debate they're on, branding each other as bigots.
Yeah, exactly.
I am thoroughly over that. Mm. I want to hear people's reasoned arguments, whichever way they fall.
Mm. Well, you got reasoned arguments on the night. I didn't think they were particularly good, but you did get some arguments. In arguing for the first, he claims lots of studies and anecdotes in his book that children brought up by same-sex couples do worse than other children. These are Deep Throat's words. I cannot but think this is a case example more than adequately demonstrated by Malcolm Roberts' presence in his obsession with climate change conspiracies.
Mm.
Decide what you want is correct and then look for evidence afterwards.
Yeah.
Here is one meta-analysis study contradicting David Van Gend. How does gender of parents matter? The gender of parents correlates in novel ways with parent-child relationships but has minor significance for children's psychological adjustment and social success. You know, we've been through this before on this program where we've gone through and we've pulled it out and that sort of stuff, and we found that... you know, not only are they doing an adequate job, they're doing a bloody good job of raising children.
And certainly no less good a job as heterosexual couples,
Yeah, exactly.
Isn't that what the evidence seems to indicate?
Well, the evidence seems to indicate that they do as good, if not better, job than what you would expect from a heterosexual couple.
Mm.
So, anyway, it's crazy. David Van Gen's second point is hard to fathom, so I completely fail to get it. It seems obvious that if one couple can marry, another couple cannot marry, that's inequality and discrimination. Surely this is society screaming at a minority group, there's something wrong with you, and this can be harmful.
Mm.
You know, and I found that argument ridiculous, where he said, you know, you've got everything you want except marriage.
Mm.
It's like you take... myself and my partner up to the top of the hill, and you stand there and you look at her and you say, this is what you can't have. Yeah, it's crazy. His third argument centred largely on the example of safe schools program and is his opinion that it's corrupting children and youth. He had some harsh words for this program. If you've read the website and online material like me, you would be forgiven for thinking David looked up the wrong website. It just did not seem to be describing the website and material that I've read.
Mm.
And, you know, it's very hard to argue with that. You know, we can go into further here. George Christensen, what can I say?
I don't know.
George Christensen
is copping a lot of flack.
He is copping a lot of flack, and with damn good reason, too.
But what's his argument?
Well, his argument was crazy in that he stood up there and he said, you know, we're on the precipice here. We're about to vote ourselves out of existence and that sort of stuff. this is Deep Throat's words. For me, the outrage by George was placing the Enlightenment within Christendom in the same breath.
Yeah.
You know, I found that ridiculous too. And
it's a bit hard to sustain, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Considering absolutely. A lot of the Enlightenment thinkers were quite specifically rebelling against the constriction or the limitations on public discourse imposed by churches.
The churches, yeah, exactly, yeah. Anyway, so that was the night when we went out there to listen to the ACL and that sort of stuff. Mm. And frankly, yeah, I mean, the big takeaway for me was they are ready for this battle. They are ready for it. The part that did concern me was when I first arrived, you had a small group of protesters out the front. And, you know, they had rainbow flags and all that sort of stuff. And they had a air horn and that sort of stuff. And they were abusing you as you went in and that sort of stuff.
So you were abused?
Yeah, I was. Well, you know, then afterwards I went up to them and introduced myself and that sort of stuff and said, look, I was with them and that sort of stuff. And, you know, we were fine then. But I failed to see what that's going to achieve.
The protest?
Yeah. It's not going to achieve anything because the people that were going in there, you weren't going to change their mind.
That's right.
It really did strike me as a wasted effort.
And look, you know, legitimate, I think peaceful, orderly protest certainly has its place and it is certainly legitimate. I'm getting a little bit tired of people trying to shut down discussion by, you know, what they call no platforming strategy, by denying people a voice that they disagree with. I think that's completely wrong.
Yeah.
If they don't agree, why not, as you did, go into the meeting, listen respectfully, and respectfully ask some questions?
Mm.
Surely that's more constructive and more likely to lead to mutual understanding than...
Well, one would have thought so, yeah.
...than trying to shout people down.
Well, and that's it, you know, because they were trying to shout them down and that sort of stuff, but, once they closed the car park off and that sort of stuff, they were too far away from the from the auditorium to hear anything. You did occasionally hear the air horn, but that was about it. By the time the thing wrapped up, we went out and they weren't there anymore. Yeah. So,
There was a discussion this afternoon on the drum about John Howard receiving an honorary doctorate from Sydney University at some time in the near future.
Oh, is he?
Yeah. And, you know, like him or not, you know, he is now a kind of elder statesman in Australian politics and... You know, these honorary doctorates, I'm not sure what I really think of them. They're just a gesture, aren't they? They're not actually saying that he has earned a doctorate, a real doctorate.
No.
It's just a way of acknowledging that he did make a contribution, like it or not. He did make a substantial contribution to the national politic. And they're acknowledging him. Apparently some small group of lecturers at Sydney University have organised a vigorous protest at the ceremony, which is at the same time, I believe, if I've got it right, a graduation ceremony for a lot of students who've worked very hard for a substantial period of their life to earn a real degree.
Yeah.
Now, you know, protest is okay, but... I sincerely hope these people are not going to go in and spoil the whole night for all those students who've, you know, laboured hard and earned their degrees.
Exactly, yeah.
I mean, let's have a discussion or a debate, but let's keep it civil.
Exactly, yeah. And from the conversation, we are a bit top-heavy on marriage equality, I'm afraid, dear listener, but anyway.
That's all right. It's a pretty substantial topic, obviously at the forefront of our discussions.
Exactly. The conversation, breaking news, marriage has very little to do with religion and vice versa. As further tensions emerge in the coalition government over the details of the proposed marriage plebiscite, reportage of the religious nature of the No campaign is becoming more prominent. Yet the relationship between religion and marriage is not clear to many people and being distorted in the media. You know, he's right. It is, you know, you've got the ACL out there arguing allegedly on behalf of Christians, but you find that the largest Protestant church in Australia, which is the Anglicans, and I've just got to try and find it. Here we go. Archbishop Peter Fryer, writing to all Australian bishops about the proposed marriage plebiscite, he said the church should accept marriage equality if it comes into law. We can still stand for, offer holy matrimony between man and a woman as a sacred ordinance given by God, while accepting that the state has endorsed a wider view of marriage.
Yeah.
And that is that they're all any of us are asking for. Is we're not asking for religions to be forced to solemnize a marriage between two men and two women.
Surely not.
No, we're not asking for that. We're simply asking that the definition, the legal definition, be expanded.
That's right. And it's all about the law. It's not about, you know, being accepted by religious authorities or religious believers. It's just about equality before the law.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm frankly often bemused by people who claim that marriage was invented by Christians. I mean, how absurd is that?
Mm.
I mean, people have been in various ways, according to the local customs of wherever they are, been hitching up for quite a long time now.
And for a long time greater since the... Well, and for a lot longer since Jesus was around, or allegedly around.
And it's not only Christians who get married.
Exactly.
I mean, I've lived in another country where they do not have a Christian majority, and let me tell you, there's a lot of married people there. In fact, probably statistically, a higher level of marriage in that country than in this country, where people have for some decades now been openly living together out of wedlock. And let me tell you, they do marriage very well there, and on a very big scale. And it's got nothing to do with Jesus or Christianity or 2,000 years. I keep hearing this number, 2,000 years.
Yeah.
It's absurd to suggest that marriage has only been around for 2,000 years.
Yeah, marriage has been around a lot longer than that.
Yeah. And it will be around, I dare say, for a lot longer than perhaps Christianity. In the future. Oh,
Paul, you're hoping for, you're hoping against hope there.
Well, we live in hope.
Yes, that's true.
And I'm not just thinking about Christianity. Of course, I'm thinking about all these archaic, superstitious traditions.
Mm. And we've just got down here, why is religion seen to be opposed to marriage equality? If the relationship between marriage law and the religious tradition is cut and dried, as Fryer explains, why is religious opposition to marriage equality reported being so significant? He's got two reasons. First, religious voices have been some of the loudest raised in opposition to marriage equality. You know, and that's very true.
It's understandable, and, you know, they're entitled to their view.
Of course they're entitled to their view, but, you know, and they've expressed it quite loudly and proudly and that sort of stuff, but anyway. And second, the dynamics of contemporary mainstream media distort the representation of religion in this context. A series of recent polls show that the majority of people of faith support marriage equality. In this matter, the Christian right is not representative of the majority of Christians. Unfortunately, media consumers are unlikely to realise this.
Mm.
And, you know, he's bang on the money there.
Yeah.
Because you go out there and you ask for a balancing opinion. So you go out there and you ask for someone from the ACL and you think you're going to be getting the Christian perspective.
Mm.
And you're not.
No, they only represent a very small section of the Christian part of the population, surely.
Yeah, they do. I mean, they've probably got their largest numbers up the road here with our friends at, you know, and the tent that's over the road at the Mount Showgrounds there. But anyway.
Mm.
Yeah. Anyway, on to SBS.
SBS?
Yes.
Let's talk about SBS.
Lib warns of gay marriage consequences. Liberal backbenchers Andrew Hastie warns redefining marriage could limit religious liberty.
Oh dear.
Yes, it's crazy. But anyway,
Andrew Hastie is coming across as a bit of a religious conservative.
He is, yes. Yes, he is.
I don't know much about the man, I have to say. But
no, he was elected in Western Australia.
There was a by-election.
There was a by-election that he got there first. I can't recall who had left, but there was a by-election for his seat. He won it, and then he won it again in the 2013 election.
All right.
Mm. And again in the 2016 election. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Here we go. Redefining marriage will potentially limit the nature and scope of religious liberty in this country. The government was interested in marriage because it produced children, he said, with broken marriages leading to increases in welfare and bureaucracy.
That's Paul, a pretty big claim, isn't
it? What would you like to say about that?
The government is interested in marriage because it produced children? Really?
That's what he said, yeah.
I thought the government doesn't really have a role in deciding whether people have children or not, do they?
No, they don't.
I remember Peter Costello urging Australian women to have three children.
Yes. I remember that night. One for yourself, one for your husband, and one for the country.
Yeah, and certainly the government is surely obliged to make policies that reflect the needs of the community, whether that's... And obviously... Part of that would be catering to the needs of families and the needs of children. But I think that's a pretty big claim to say the government is only interested in marriage to the degree that it produces children.
Mm.
That's a bit of a stretch, isn't it?
Oh, I would have thought so, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm.
Doesn't he have any more to say than that?
He goes on... We're not seeking to redefine Parliament. Mr. Hastie disagrees with his colleague Dean Smith, who argues the plebiscite is a matter that will undermine the principles of parliamentary sovereignty.
Huh?
Yes. We are not seeking to redefine Parliament. We are seeking to redefine marriage, Mr. Hastie writes. Mm. Where Smith invests authority in parliamentary sovereignty, I choose to invest in the people. You know, we will talk about the whole plebiscite after.
But we live in a liberal democracy where surely the overarching principle is that individuals are entitled to make their own choices about their own lives in accordance, you know, within the confines of the law, obviously. The government doesn't really, as I see it, have a role in determining whether or not married people have children, do they?
No, they don't.
No.
Yeah.
So it's a bit of a bold claim.
Well, it is a bold claim. I mean, like, considering that Reverend Fred Nile, who's 80-something in the shade, isn't he?
Possibly,
yeah,
yes. He's getting up there.
He's getting up there. You know, he's married a woman that's 50-something.
Well, half his luck.
Yeah. Yeah, clearly... They're not getting married for the procreation of the species, are they?
Oh, they're not?
No.
Oh, they're not planning to have children? Okay. Yeah, I would have thought, being a good Christian man, that would have been his main motivation, surely.
Well, apparently not, yeah.
Interesting.
The Sydney Morning Herald. Liberal Party members behind same-sex marriage misinformation campaign. Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull's promise of a civil debate over same-sex marriage is unravelling, with the group behind an anti-equality smear sheet distributed in suburban Sydney revealed as members of the Liberal Party.
Yeah.
The group Children's Future, which has a firm link to the secretive Catholic religious society Opus Dei, has made the false claim in leaflets that legalising same-sex marriage could trigger the controversial Safe Schools program becoming compulsory in all Australian schools, even if parents objected.
Mm.
You know, the difference between, safe schools and the religious instruction is that it's delivered by competent teachers.
Mm-hmm.
It's not delivered by renegade enthusiasts for the faith,
mm-hmm,
or anything like that.
Yeah.
It's delivered by competent teachers.
Okay.
And in that respect, even if it is compulsory, you've got to understand that, even if it is compulsory, you've got to understand that it's being delivered by a by a teacher.
Yeah, by professional teachers who probably have a broader understanding of the needs of children and certainly what they need to grow and develop into mature, well balanced and adjusted adults.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm.
Okay. What do you think, Scott, about the idea of the plebiscite?
Well, the plebiscite itself doesn't really offend me. It is, I know we've got different views on this, but my biggest concern is that if you've got this situation now with the Parliament the way it is and that sort of stuff, the only way forward for marriage equality in this term of Parliament is via the plebiscite. Now, assuming in 3 years' time the coalition wins again, we're going to end up with the same argument, aren't we? We're going to end up with the coalition saying, back a plebiscite now, the Labor Party saying, no, we want the government, we want the Parliament to decide.
Mm-hmm.
The only difference is 3 years has elapsed. Yes, the plebiscite is expensive.
And non-binding.
Exactly. It's non-binding. But even when you've got people like Tony Abbott saying that he will vote depending on how the electorate votes, that in itself gives me some cause for relief. I think that he's... You know, if he's prepared to vote yes for something that the public votes yes for, then that would be fine by me. And your views on the plebiscite, Paul?
I think it's a colossal waste of money, considering it's a non-binding vote. It's basically, as others have described it, an expensive opinion poll. I don't think it will change the minds of very many in the coalition. You know, those who actually hold the power to change the law, I think most of them have probably already made up their minds which way they fall on the debate.
Yeah, of course. And George Christensen would be one.
I don't think the plebiscite's going to change any of their minds, frankly. It's probably not going to change the minds of any members of Parliament.
Mm.
So why have it? Why not just have a vote on the floor of the House?
Well, if you have a vote on the floor of the House right now, it will be passed. It'll be passed by a very narrow majority, but it will be passed. It will be passed in both houses of Parliament.
Yeah.
So that's where it's at there. If you have a plebiscite first and you do get 60 or 70% of the population voting yes to changing the law and allowing marriage equality, I think you'll end up with a higher number of people voting for it in the Parliament.
So you think some members of Parliament will change their minds?
Yeah, they will.
Yeah, I'm not convinced.
Yeah. Well, I can't imagine Barnaby Joyce going back into Parliament after having his electorate vote
in favour of it
and him voting against it. I can't imagine George Christensen doing that.
I can imagine virtually any of them doing it because I think members of Parliament often, once elected, you know, they labour under the delusion that they are the opinion of their electorate.
That's true, yeah, that is true.
So, look, I frankly think if John Howard could change the law with relation to marriage without a plebiscite, why can't it be changed again without a plebiscite?
Yeah, of course, it could be changed without a plebiscite. The problem is, though,
that it won't be.
It won't be. Now, we've got an article here from Brisbane Times which says, make no mistake, Labor and the Coalition are playing politics with same-sex marriage. It starts off beautifully. It's hard to recall a bigger failure in recent history from Australian political class than the debacle of legalising same-sex marriage. It is hard to find something. Anyway, so he goes through. The first failure in same-sex marriage schmozzle belongs to Abbott. Rather than letting MPs do their job and vote on legislation, the former Prime Minister, egged on by the Conservative wing of his party, proposed an expensive plebiscite to resolve the matter. The second failure was Malcolm Turnbull. Rather than junking the plebiscite proposal, he argued against Communications Minister, Turnbull acquiesced to the demands of the party Conservatives and retained his part of the deal when struck to install him as Prime Minister. The third failure now unfolding belongs to Bill Shorten and members of the same-sex marriage lobby, like Rodney Coombe, who used this support, used to support a plebiscite but now oppose it. You know, he's right. There are three people that have failed in this, Abbott, Turnbull and Shorten, you know. But we're also at a situation now that Turnbull's stuck. He has to go ahead with it. He has to give the people what they want.
Or at least give the people what he has told them he will give them.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, it's clear that Turnbull is in a difficult position. We all know that.
Yeah.
But as others have said, if he had any backbone, he would stand up and say what he really thinks about the issue.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's...
I mean, people keep calling for political leadership, and he's not providing very much, frankly.
No, that's very true. He's not providing very much. He's not providing very much leadership on this. And, you know, I think that one of the things that I find amusing about this is that the numbers that are continually represented suggest 60 or 70% of the population are in favour of this.
That's what we keep hearing.
Yes. You would assume, therefore, that in a plebiscite you're going to get 60, 65% coming back. Yes.
Mm.
And that's...
But it's not assured, is it?
No, it's not assured.
And I think what a lot of people are afraid of is that the anti-same-sex, the anti-marriage equality bodies, whoever they are, will mount such a vociferous and effective campaign. I mean, all they have to do, basically, I suppose, is put enough doubt. And they don't have to totally convince people. They have to put enough doubt into people's minds that they become unsure of whether they still support it, that they might just vote no, and the plebiscite will come back with a no vote. Is that right?
Yeah, that's one of the things that I think is concerning people, yeah. Yes, is that you could end up with a situation where you end up with a no vote.
Yeah. And look, I'm personally not against the plebiscite on the grounds that people will say nasty things. I mean, that's the nature of a conversation about a contentious topic, is that some people, not everybody, but some people will almost inevitably say nasty things about other people. Surely as a community we can be mature enough to basically accept that people will have a different view, and if some people say nasty things, I personally would just say, well, I'm sorry, but you know, the nastiness I'll just put to one side. I want to hear your reasoned discussion on the issue. And but of course, I suppose there is the fear that some people will be persuaded to vote no just because fear will become a big factor.
That's true. You know, I have fallen on the side of fist with this. I think that the nasty, ugly debate will actually be good for the country because it will expose the church for what they are.
Well, there's that too. Exactly.
They will be outed as the mean pig dog criminal bastards I've called them before. But I think the final word can go to... this gentleman, James Masola, who was writing for the Brisbane Times, when he wrote, "Labor is in effect demanding that Turnbull take a knife and cheerfully commit seppuku, the Japanese form of ritual suicide by disembowelment of his own prime ministership." Now, that is, I think, the final thing holding Turnbull back from granting a conscience vote.
Considering the result of the last federal election,
yes,
you'd have to assume that Turnbull is skating on relatively thin ice.
You would think so, yes.
Yeah. So perhaps...
Yeah, although, if the party did go back to Abbott, it would be a disaster for them. You know, they would lose next
I can't
election.
See them going back to Abbott.
No, but they could go to Morrison.
Ooh. There's a prospect for you. Do you think he's realistically a prospect for the leadership?
Well, not now. He is in a couple of years' time. He is probably the leader in waiting.
I don't know. I've never found Morrison particularly convincing on anything.
No, he's not.
But of course, there may well be people out there who do.
Well, there are, and you know, he is from the hard right and that sort of stuff, which. You know, once Turnbull's finished with the job and that sort of stuff, it's looking like it'll be the hard right's turn.
And we all know that he's from the conservative Christian wing of the party.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Mm. Yeah.
So, what else can we say about it?
Well, I think we've probably done that to death, you know. So we'll move on now to media release. 78% want religion out of government.
Mm.
And that was very good, wasn't it?
That was interesting.
It was interesting, yes. It came out, I got this from the party's website and on the Secular Party Facebook page. Yes. So I got it from there.
Yes.
And it is very interesting. So, Paul, would you like to talk us through it or do you want me to do it?
No, you go ahead.
Okay. A national poll in January shows 78% of Australians don't want religion to interfere with social policy, and 72% think the Constitution should clearly separate church and state, says Brian Morris, Director of Plain Reason. Hmm. Brian Morris, we've talked about him before. He was the author behind the Purple Economy and that sort of stuff.
Hmm, yes.
He is, I met him. He's he comes up here for the Queensland Humanist Society.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. Church leaders and many politicians wrongly claim our constitution is founded on Christian values and morally oppose contemporary policies such as same-sex marriage.
Mm.
You know, he's right. It's nothing more infuriating than Pauline Hanson saying Australia is a Christian nation.
Yes.
It's not a Christian nation. No. You know, it was the founders and that sort of stuff set it up so it wouldn't be. And section 116 of the constitution says it shouldn't be.
Mm.
You know, Australia to be a secular nation. But a more explicit secular clause would deter politicians from bending to religious authorities who assert constitutional Christian values to block legislation on same-sex marriage and voluntary euthanasia. I think he's right. Now, I'm not one that calls for referendums and that sort of stuff all the time and that sort of stuff. I'm just not.
Mm.
But you do often wonder whether or not if the Constitution actually spilled it out, saying that Australia is a secular nation, that Australia must keep its church and government separate, whether or not they would have actually tried to fund these school chaplains program. Mm.
Yeah.
You know, you would think that... if it was separated out, if it was explicit in the Constitution saying that they've got to be separated, you would think that they would avoid the appearance of...
I have to plead ignorance on the Constitution. I haven't actually read it, but I would assume that back in the days when the Federation was first established, that there would have been a higher proportion of the population who did profess to be practicing Christians than now.
You would think so, yes.
Yes, yeah. And if there wasn't a strong statement, you know, of the Christian nature of the nation, then you would think logically it should be even less now.
You would think so, yes.
Because everybody knows people are far less religious now than they were 115 years ago.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, but do we need a specific statement in the Constitution to that effect? Perhaps we do. I'm not sure.
Well, you know, it's possibly one of those things that you should consider doing if you, you know, when Australia becomes a republic, it's probably the time then to go through and say, you know, let's revamp the Constitution.
Yes.
Let's insert a secular clause in it there.
Indeed. Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Unsurprising that. A lot of people don't see a role for religion in the affairs of state.
Mm.
I mean, that just stands to reason, doesn't it?
It is. It does just stand to reason.
Yeah,
exactly.
And as for the claim that Australia was established as a Christian nation, where's the evidence, you know?
Well, there is none.
Yeah, and it's even less of a Christian nation now. And I, you know, I'm often, again, bemused by people who claim that our civilization is a Christian civilization. You know, there are obviously strong influences from Christianity, from Judeo-Christianity. But from where I sit, the European Enlightenment is the by far the most impressive and substantial influence on our contemporary civilization. You know, the idea of liberal democracy, which values the rights of the individual citizen as paramount, that's not about Christianity. Christianity is about bowing down to some imaginary friend that you call Lord.
Mm.
You know, that's not to me classic liberalism
at
all.
No, it's not. No,
that's a kind of monarchy type of idea.
It is
monarchical. Yeah,
yeah.
So this idea that we're a Christian nation is patently absurd.
Yeah, it is. It is completely absurd. Yeah. It's nonsense and it's garbage, and 78% want religion out of government.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's great.
Let's get on with it.
Exactly.
Let's get religion out of government.
Yes, precisely. Yeah. Mm. This one's from the Washington Times, September 18. Candidates face rising non-theist bloc.
Ooh.
Yes. So that is very good news from the United States.
Mm.
Atheists, agnostics, and others religiously unaffiliated say their time is about to come in American politics, insisting that candidates from the federal to local level will soon start trying to win them over.
It's interesting, isn't it? And, you know, we are seeing some changes taking place in the United States. Not all good, of course, but, you know, I refuse to give up on our good friends over in the United States.
Yeah, as do I. You know,
there are some very decent, good people who are not religious who are trying to make that country into a better place.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and you listen to them, you know, you listen to Sam Harris and that sort of stuff, and you think to yourself, well, he's an American.
Yes.
And he's
a shining beacon of rationality, isn't it? In a stormy sea of irrationality.
Yes, he is. And then we got a quote here. I personally think this is going to be the last presidential election where we are not going to hear more about the non-theist community, says Larry Decker, executive director of the group.
Yes, I think we will see the non-theists, or at least the non-religious people in the United States more and more standing up and making their voices heard.
I think we're going to have to, yeah.
And it's about time, too.
It is about time, too, because, you know, those of us sitting here on the other side of the planet, when you turn on the television and you hear the nonsense that Donald Trump is sprouting and that sort of stuff, and then and Hillary, too, you know, she's carried on with some nonsense, too. You know, you hear them both and you think to yourself, they are all a pack of church wackies over there. But when you look at other stuff, you find that they're not.
I'd be very surprised if either of those two are sincere believers.
Yeah.
I'd be very surprised.
Yeah.
Donald Trump, his God is himself.
Yes.
Hillary Clinton, she's probably fairly typical of a lot of, secular Americans, more or less secular Americans who... You know, they mouth the words that they know the voters expect them to say.
Yeah, exactly.
That, you know, paying their respects to religious sensibilities.
Mm.
Barack Obama, as much as I like him as a person, he does sometimes disappoint me with his mealy-mouthed sort of kowtowing to religious sensibilities. I wouldn't be at all surprised if Obama was a closet atheist.
It wouldn't surprise me either.
But of course, he has probably correctly judged that he couldn't come out and say that publicly and get elected as president.
Yeah.
I think the time will come where that will no longer be the case. I don't know how far in the future, but it'll be interesting. The next 10, 20 years, I wouldn't be at all surprised if we see the election of a completely unaffiliated, non-religious person to that office.
And it really is, it's well overdue. It's another country that you often hear them saying, oh, we're a, you know, we're a Christian nation and that sort of stuff, and they're not. You know?
No, it's in their constitution, much more clearly than in ours,
yes,
that
exactly.
They are that the government has no business with religion.
Mm. Mm. Exactly,
yeah.
It's maddening, but anyway.
Yeah.
Oh, dear. Essential Media Report. Now, first up, two-party preferred, Paul, Labor and Coalition. What are the numbers?
Oh, gee, I didn't do my homework on this one, did I? two-party preferred. I think I saw something in passing in the last couple of days that put Labor marginally, very marginally ahead. Is that right?
52 versus 48.
There you go.
Mm.
Well, that's not even too marginal, is it, in Australian politics?
It's not marginal, no. That's it's actually quite a significant number.
Mm.
You know, it proves that if an election was held today, then Turnbull would be out on his
back. Yeah, well, he came very close
yeah.
a couple of months ago, didn't he?
He did. Now, what was also interesting in this report was the Essential report had gone through and they asked the thorny question about banning Muslim immigration.
Mm.
Now... We can go there. What do you think?
We frequently go there, let's face it. Yeah, look, I'm personally not... I wouldn't advocate banning Muslim immigration. I do have reservations about inviting large numbers of people who perhaps would not fit well into the Australian cultural landscape. But, you know, I think that is partly a failing of the way so-called multiculturalism has been presented and how it's been described. I mean, you know, it started with Al Grasby, didn't it, back in...
I couldn't tell you.
Yeah, and well, maybe even before him. But, look, I think it was an entirely legitimate project to... diversify Australia's cultural makeup. But at the same time, what we've seen in the post-war migration was people who came to this country and within a generation or at the most within a couple of generations, they integrated. Now, I know the word assimilation is a dirty word for some people. It isn't
it's
for
not
me.
A, no, it's not
it
for
isn't
me,
for
either.
Me. I mean, what else would you want but a well-integrated society?
A homogenous society.
Where people may have different views on certain things, but overall they share common values. And values of social peace and harmony, cooperation, constructive engagement. Surely, to goodness, we wouldn't be... pretending that if there are elements in the community that are not integrating well and beyond that perhaps even causing problems, and look, you know, don't get me wrong, I'm not casting aspersions on the entire Muslim community at all, you know, obviously, you know, as it's been said numerous times ad nauseum, you know, most Muslims are law-abiding, peaceful people. We all know that.
Mm.
However, there is increasingly an element in the Muslim community, not just in Australia, this is a global phenomenon, that the loudest voices appear to be the extremists, if I can use that word. And they appear to be, in some cases, intimidating other members of the Muslim community into acquiescing to their program or to their views, or at least being intimidated enough that they don't stand up and publicly oppose them. Now, you know, we've seen with Europe that there are now enclaves in what are otherwise perfectly well-functioning liberal democracies in Europe. There are now they have enclaves of people who don't really subscribe to the values of the general community. Now, that's got to ring alarm bells for anyone, surely.
It really does. I mean, it is... well, I mean, the one you were describing there sounds very much to me like Paris.
Yeah.
You know, and there's an area in Paris, I don't know what it's called, I've never been there, but it is... it's the place where they have all the high-rise towers and that sort of stuff, and there's social housing and that sort of thing. What you find there is that you've got a large number of Muslims who live in that area, and you've got it officially or unofficially anyway. I think unofficially, you've got the situation that you've got the gendarmes won't go into the area.
Or at least they go in with great trepidation.
Exactly. You know.
Now, Karen Phelps, remember we were watching her earlier on an edition of The Drum.
Yes.
I think she put it very well. She said, listen, people are legitimately concerned. We are witnessing something on a global scale, not just in Australia. We are witnessing something unprecedented.
Mm.
We are seeing people in various countries committing absolute atrocities. Now, what we've seen happen in France and in Belgium and in other countries is it has to ring alarm bells, surely, because these were not commandos going into the country from some hostile foreign power. These were people who were resident or who had entered the country more or less without any checks or opposition. You know, whether they arrived as refugees, I don't know, but it would appear that most of them were resident. Some of them were born in those countries. This has got to be an issue of concern for anybody. Now, those who shout down people who are worried about Muslim immigration and accusing them of racism or bigotry, this is a legitimate discussion that we need to have, and we need to say whatever is, you know, whatever the facts support or whatever the evidence supports.
Mm.
So it doesn't mean we're anti-Muslim immigration, but surely we have the right as a community to have our government make responsible decisions on our behalf.
Mm.
And if they are, you know, sort of pretending there isn't a problem, which I get the impression a lot of politicians just don't want to name the problem.
Mm.
They just don't want to go there for fear of, one, being labelled racists and bigots, and two, losing votes at the next whatever election. But it's a discussion we need to have.
Yeah, I think you're right. It is a discussion we do need to have. It's a... and I don't think it's a discussion that need be brutal or anything like that.
No.
It can be... You know, like the two of us, we've just had a discussion then, and we've not pointed the finger at each other or anything like that.
Mm.
You know, I do take your point when we go back to talking about France and Belgium. My understanding was a number of those attackers were actually born in France.
Yes.
You know.
That's my understanding too.
Yeah.
Now, or at least, they were either born there or they had migrated there at a very early age and had effectively... adopted the nationality of the country they were living in.
Exactly. And then to have a situation that it beggars belief. It really boggles the mind what it was that sent them over the edge, that they thought that this was the way to behave, was to do what they did.
And I think, I dare say that's a very complex... phenomenon.
Mm.
I don't think it's correct to say it's all about religion, but I do absolutely think religion is a big factor, and we need to understand it. We need to understand it, and how on earth are we going to understand it if people are afraid to talk about it openly and honestly?
Yeah, exactly. It is something that we should have that discussion with now, and we should have that discussion now while we've only got 2.2% of the population being of the Islamic faith.
That's right.
And we should have this discussion in the way you and I are having this discussion
exactly.
now. And we could have it with imams and everything else around the table. And we might well just influence the next generation.
Yeah.
You know.
And as you say, we have to have a respectful discussion. Surely there are members of the Muslim community who would agree with us.
I would have thought so.
That if there are elements in their community or dare I say it, in their religion that are antithetical to our Western liberal democratic values, then we need to identify them and we need to assist perhaps people in the Muslim community to change the values of their beliefs or their community values. I'm not sure. But surely it's a discussion we need to have. Pretending that there isn't a problem, saying Islam is a religion of peace, nobody believes that anymore. I don't think even most Muslims would believe that anymore. I think there are a lot of Muslims that are deeply disturbed about what is happening in the name of their religion. Now, I'm not suggesting for a moment that most Muslims support murdering innocent civilians. But unfortunately, there does appear to be an element of the faith, the religion, you know, of their teachings that just are not a good fit with 21st century liberal democracy. And I sincerely hope members of the Muslim community are honest enough to admit that and to try to find ways through this. Try to find ways where they can become more legitimately peaceful, well accepted, totally well integrated members of our community.
Well, I think that's right, and I think that one of the things that they should do first up is argue for the reform of their holy book.
Yes,
it really has to change. You know, it's. You know, Surah, whatever it is, 19 or 9-11 or whatever it was, that calls for killing the unbeliever.
That's right.
They've got to get rid of that.
At least they have to challenge it openly and say whether or not they agree with it or disagree with it.
Mm.
Surely. Mm. I mean, you know, even Christians, let's face it, and, you know, you hear people say, well, there are violent things in the Bible, and certainly there are, but... You know, let's be real. Most Christians these days are not going to, you know, if they get married and they find their wife wasn't a virgin before they got married, they're not going to haul her back to the home of the parents and then call everybody out to stone her to death.
Yeah, exactly.
And that is in the Bible.
Yeah.
But most Christians, accept that is no longer an acceptable principle.
Exactly.
In this day and age, in this type of society we live in. What we need is for Muslims to publicly stand up and say there are elements in the teachings of the Islamic religion that are no longer, not only no longer relevant, but absolutely unacceptable.
Mm,
and exactly. That's what we need.
Mm.
More Muslims to stand up and say, okay, I practice in a peaceful manner. I respect the peaceful elements of my religion, but I absolutely refute the bad parts.
Mm, exactly. Anyway, we started this discussion about the Essential Report. So what was the total of support for this proposed ban on Muslim immigration?
What was the support? It was something like... was it two-thirds, 60%, something like that?
No, it's 49% were in support.
Wow.
40% were opposed, and that would mean that the
11%
were under, don't know.
It was a higher proportion that were in favour of banning it than were against banning it.
Yeah, I mean, strongly support was 28% versus strongly opposed was 21%.
Mm.
Support was 21, opposed was 19.
There you go. Mm.
Yeah, it's reason for supporting the bans, they do not integrate into Australian society, was 41%. And that's, well, it's, you know, that is the conversation we've just had, is that there's a whole range of reasons why you would think that and that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
So I think it's a legitimate concern that people have got, and I don't think there's any point hiding from it. I think that the only thing to do is to have the conversation and get it done.
And look, you know, the Australian society is not a mirror image of European societies, but surely we'd be foolish not to look at what has happened in Europe and how things have developed and turned out there. And you know, can we not do better? Can we not find a better path? Do we want enclaves? Do we want, insular enclaves developing in our cities?
Well, I don't think we do.
No. And some people would suggest it's already starting to happen in the capital cities. Certainly in Sydney. I'm not sure about Melbourne, but I know there are areas of Sydney where non-Muslim Australians feel that they're no longer really part of the community. Is that a fair assumption?
I think that's probably fair. You know, Lakemba, for example, is
an
area
that comes to mind. Yeah, yes,
is an area that is very heavy Muslims. Yeah. Yes. Anyway, on to cheerier topics.
Yeah. And look, don't get me wrong. I'm all for, you know, having a range of cuisines at
As am I. Yeah.
And nice colourful clothing. What I have a problem with is not different forms of clothing or different styles of eating or, you know, all those superficial trappings of culture. What I'm against is bad ideas, Scott. I just don't want people in Australia growing up with and sharing bad antisocial ideas.
Exactly. The Age. Religious discrimination laws paying the price for faith-based hiring. This is an article in relation to the Andrews government, who's turning out to be the most progressive government in the country.
Certainly shaping up that way.
Yes, it really is. And the Andrews government is going to... where is it? Can't see it, I'm afraid, dear listener. They are planning on... reintroducing a law that was on the books and that sort of stuff, and it got thrown out by the incoming Liberal government. They're going to reintroduce it. Now, this law is going to interfere with the way religious organisations can hire and fire. And I don't have a problem with that. You know, it's myself and the Iron Fist have been through it and that sort of stuff. We have discussed it before.
Yeah.
It's staff who are completely ancillary and that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
They are got nothing to do with kids or anything else.
Such as gardeners.
Exactly. Yeah.
Office administrators.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Why would their personal religious beliefs or non-beliefs be a factor in them doing their jobs?
It shouldn't.
Shouldn't be.
You wouldn't think so. No, you wouldn't think so. But anyway, there'll be a link to this on the website, ladies and gentlemen, so I encourage you to have a read of that. Yeah. And the Sydney Morning Herald, the last one for the evening. 300K ethics and scripture class review kept under wraps for up to 9 months. The findings and recommendations of a controversial $300,000 review of special religious education and ethics classes in schools has been kept under wraps by the New South Wales government for up to 9 months. You got to wonder why, don't you?
Yeah, what happened to transparency in government?
Well, God knows. But, you know, it really is crazy that they went through the... Here it is. The review by ARTD Consultants cost $295,988 to conclude.
Yeah.
You got to wonder why, if you then dedicated yourself to spend that amount of money, why you'd want to keep it all under wraps, you know?
The fact that it's taxpayers' money that was spent, surely the taxpayers have a right to know what happened with all that money and what was the outcome. Of course, we know the Premier of New South Wales is a...
religious.
Openly a practicing Christian. Nothing wrong with that.
No.
But if he's spending taxpayers' money on a review of something that affects the general community, and that's his job, he needs to be open and transparent about what the money's been spent on and what do we get for that money.
Exactly, yeah.
Does he have an agenda, one wonders.
Anyway, it came after documents obtained under Freedom of Information laws revealed religious groups blamed the introduction of ethics classes for falling participation in special religious education classes for 2015 school year. Well, hello. You know.
Indeed. Why wouldn't parents want their children to attend ethics classes? Surely ethics is an essential component of the intellectual and emotional development of children, isn't it? I mean, surely we want ethical citizens. So why wouldn't parents want ethics as a component of their children's education?
Well, God alone knows why, but yes. Apparently they didn't, you know.
And hardly surprising that, you know, parents are seeing the ethics class as a viable and perhaps superior alternative to having some Iron Age superstition drummed into the heads of their kids.
Well, that's exactly right. You know, it's crazy to think that you're going to get a better result out of your kids if you send them through to an Iron Age class. Yeah. As opposed to an ethics class.
Yeah, 21st century ethics, yeah. Yes, citizenry and ethics classes, yes.
Yeah.
Look, one of my children did logic and ethics at high school. It was his favourite subject.
Is that right?
Yeah, he enjoyed it a lot because it taught him how to think, Scott, how to think critically about just about everything and anything, and it didn't just fill his head with some dogma that was cooked up, you know, 2,000 to 3,000 years ago.
Exactly.
Yeah. So it was very good value, and I would urge the listener to, if the listener still has school age children.
If the listener is in New South Wales, then please.
Or wherever. I'd like to see this sort of thing happening more and more around Australia.
Yeah.
Our children definitely need more than just literacy and numeracy. They need, you know, they need exposure to the, you know, the philosophical currents, or, you know, probably the last 2,000 to 3,000 years, you know, just to give them some perspective on where we are now, where we've come from, and where we might go in the future with this this civilization project of ours. I think it's an altogether healthy and constructive measure to introduce ethics into the lives of our children.
Paul, we might disagree on the plebiscite, but we can agree on that.
I take some comfort from that, Scott.
Well, that's everything for tonight, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for tuning in. And
thank you, listener,
very much for being here, Paul.
My pleasure always, Scott.
I'm pleased to hear that. Okie dokes. Well, that's everything from us, and keep smiling.
Yep. See you.
See you. Bye now.
Well, dear listener, did you enjoy that episode of the podcast? If you did, I've got a favour to ask. First up, tell some friends. Let them know about the podcast. You'll be discussing something at some time, and you might be repeating something I've said. And when you're talking to your friends, say, hey, I heard this on this podcast, and it's worth listening to. And maybe pick an episode that you think's a good one and direct them to it. Like, grab their phone and go to their podcast app and search for Iron Fist Velvet Glove and subscribe on their behalf on their phone and just put the word out. The other thing is you could become a patron and support the show. So if you go to our website, you'll see a link to Patreon, and there are some different options for subscribing and paying per episode. And really the amount that you pay depends on what you get from the podcast. So there's different levels ranging from $1.50 Australian to, I think, $10 and various ones in between. It's really, what do you think it's worth? Is it worth a cup of coffee? Is it worth more than that, less than that? Whatever you get out of it, because not everybody gets the same. Maybe you don't listen to the whole thing. Maybe you never talk about it with people. Maybe you really couldn't care less half the time whether the podcast is there. It'll be different for everybody. So if you get a lot out of the podcast, contribute a bit more. If you don't get much, contribute less. But in any event, you can subscribe there. If you don't like the idea of a regular subscription, the website has a link to a PayPal donation. So you could just do a one-off donation every now and again. So there you go. It'd be good to spread the word, get a few more listeners. And that way, look, if we ended up getting more listeners and more money, we could do maybe a second episode or more special episodes, provide some more content. So it's up to you. If you think it's worthwhile, let people know. Thanks.